to move in and give him 30% of everything they grew every year. This is how they'd pay the rent. His name was Rensselaer. He became one of the richest.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering, a Women of Color panel, on Thursday, February 21st at 10 a.m. at the Abundant Life Church in Portland. In honor of Engineers Week, Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering features a panel of six local women of color engineers talking about their career paths and answering questions. The panel is moderated by Cheryl Norris. Again, that's Spark a Girl's Interest in Engineering, a Women of Color panel, on Thursday, February 21st at 10 a.m. at the Abundant Life Church, 3935 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock, almost 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's The Radio Activist, today featuring suicide prevention programs in the Portland metro area. And the Oregon Arts Council is holding conversations about race. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, broadcasting from Tucson, Arizona, with ethnic studies professor and human rights activist Nolan Cabrera. At 11 o'clock on Food Sleuth Radio, dietitian Melinda Hemmelgarn helps listeners think beyond their plates and connect the dots between food, health, agriculture, and also find food truth. And then 11:30, Making Contact features I Am Not Your Negro master filmmaker Raoul Peck, and he envisions the book that James Baldwin never finished, which was called Remember This House. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO this morning. We're going to get right to The Radio Activists.
Good morning. I am Suzanne LeGrand, host of The Radio Activist, along with my compatriot Lisa Loving.
Hey.
Today on The Radio Activist, we are talking first to Brittany Wake, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Trainer. And on the second half, we will be talking to Morgan Leitz with the Oregon Youth Lines for Suicide Prevention. So let's start with Brittany. Welcome.
Good morning.
Brittany, could you tell us a little bit about what you do as an equity, diversity, and inclusion trainer and educator?
Yeah, absolutely. So my official role is I'm also a professional counselor. Within that work, I do equity, diversity, and inclusion work, really recognizing the mental health system as a system and as such, one of those places that subjugates and oppresses people of marginalized communities. And so I provide equity, diversity, and inclusion specifically within that realm, providing training to other mental health professionals, other healthcare professionals, really to allow folks to see how we are contributing as a system, even with the best intentions, to the marginalization of really vulnerable communities.
What does inclusion and diversity training look like? What does that involve?
You know, it looks like a lot of different things. Oftentimes it looks like just basic education. So talking about, you know, what is racism? So we have all of these ideas about what a racist is or what racism is, but really nailing down like what actually is racism so that we can come to a common so we can share some common language. What is sexism so that people don't get confused when we hear terminology like reverse racism or heterophobia, all of those things that are just additional ways to oppress individuals of marginalized communities. So setting a foundation of common language is the most challenging, and it seems to be the work that is done most often in equity, diversity, and inclusion.
You also do work which you call trauma responsiveness.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, so there's a big push. So many people in the healthcare field, particularly in the mental health field, know about trauma-informed care. And trauma-informed care is an amazing framework to understand the way that people in their everyday lives, and also when they're of a particular vulnerable community, experience trauma. And that can be historical trauma. It could be an event. It could be a set of circumstances, right? Just recognizing the trauma in people's lives. The way that I practice trauma responsiveness as different than trauma informed is not only recognizing it, but doing something about it. And that includes the trauma that comes from being a person who experiences oppression in this society, recognizing that as trauma, and that as something that contributes to the overall health challenges and disparities of people of color, of queer people, of trans people, of any marginalized group. Our lives are in jeopardy daily, and being responsive to that trauma is critical.
Yeah, wow. How is it that institutions can be more mindful of some of the things that you're talking about, particularly trauma responsiveness?
Yeah, one of the ways to be mindful is to know how your system contributes, how it has historically contributed, and the way that it's contributing today to the sense of dis-ease among communities. So speaking for, you know, the mental health community as a member of it, historically we've done that. So we've built systems that say that you are generally less well if you are a person of color. Even now, some severe and persistent mental illness diagnoses like schizophrenia are disproportionately attributed to people of color. Being gay was just taken out of the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders, in the 70s, right? And so, and even now, having to have a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, which is better, it's an improvement upon what the DSM was before, but still needing a diagnosis of gender dysphoria even for a person to move through with gender affirmation. To be themselves. So knowing how your field has contributed to the burden among marginalized
And it also seems to me the other half is also recognizing better that oppression does make people sick.
Absolutely. That's the other side of that coin, is that people aren't sick because there's something wrong with them. People are sick because there's something wrong with our society, and the way that people are treated. So that's absolutely the other side of that coin, is knowing how being a part of that system and those different systems daily contributes to mental health challenges.
Mm-hmm. And it also seems to me that there's a criticism that's raised of therapy that it deals with the individual, but the institutions or the larger structures of society are part of the problem.
Absolutely.
And I think your work addresses that. Is there any way to connect therapy to larger structural change?
Absolutely. So therapists, many therapists are engaged in a lot of different sorts of activism, whether that be holding community space with marginalized communities, whether that be interacting. I actually just sent an email to Ron Wyden and Errol Blumauer this morning about, I might have just messed up Blumenauer's name, but
Earl.
Yeah, Earl. That sounds good. But sent an email today about therapists being involved in the Medicare system. So there are ways to lobby. There are ways that therapists just create space, providing education. So one of the ways that I intend to subvert the system is providing education to my clients. Not my equity, diversity, and inclusion clients, but my mental health clients, and providing them with education about the ways that the system works, the way that the system has created these things that make us unwell, and that psychoeducation is another way of engaging in activism, and I think that therapists can just change their work by also we work with policies, we do all sorts of different things, and I think that, to your point about the criticism, I think a lot of therapists also feel helpless because we do get told that our role is individual and, you know, just in the counseling room, but we work well outside of that, and just getting to a point where that's more of a standard is what I hope to bring to that community.
You also are a facilitator with the Oregon Humanities Conversation Project.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about what that project is and what you do with it?
Yeah, the Conversation Project and just Oregon Humanities altogether, they're a wonderful organization. And what they do with the Conversation Project is they provide an opportunity for Oregonians, all Oregonians, so across the state, to come together and to have conversations about things that matter. Things that can feel like they will elicit conflict. Those are the subjects that they care about even more, right? So they have a desire to move toward equity and inclusion, and the Conversation Project is one way to do that. They have, I want to say, around 60 different conversations that are being had across the state about. You know, wealth and wealth gaps, and there's one on fake news. The Conversation Project that I lead is about good people, what it means to be a quote unquote good person in a society of structural oppression. So thinking about our individual roles in participating in those systems of racism and sexism and heterosexism.
That's excellent. So question about that, what it means to be a good person.
Yeah.
It's very provocative. Why is that something we need to actually explore? I mean, isn't it that, you know, if you do good things and you are well-intentioned, that's enough?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you said that. So that's a part of the conversation. So what I do in my conversation is I show this clip of Dr. Robin DiAngelo, who has focused all of her work on working through the construct of whiteness. And so she, I believe, coined the phrase white fragility. And what Dr. Robin DiAngelo says in that brief clip that I show is she breaks down the good bad binary. So one of those words that she uses is well-intentioned, right? So she says that we think of good people as northern and educated and young and well-intentioned compared to our idea of a racist person who is typically characterized as old and southern and mean and bigoted and all of these ideas, these schemas that we have about these particular people. But what she says is that this good bad binary sets up a dynamic that keeps racism and other structures of oppression in place, that our clinging to being good people, that our desire to not be called racist, to not be called sexist, that desire outweighs any other expectation of us moving through it, that we're more focused on what we're called than what we're doing. So mm-hmm. that if we're well-intentioned, or, oh, I didn't mean to say that, or I didn't mean it like that, and you're taking it the wrong way, that puts the onus on the other person to make the person who engaged in the behavior feel like, oh, I'm not calling you a bad person, right? So we're more focused on being good than we are on being correct.
And it also strikes me that recenters the conversation on the people who are already at the center, right? On their feelings and, you know, or being hurt rather than right. actually dealing with what is at issue.
Right, because it's all about their self-concept. It's not about what's actually happening. It's about what does it mean for me to have done something that is racist? What does it mean for me to have done something that is hurtful to the queer community? What does it mean for me to perpetuate sexist behavior? It means that I'm a bad person. It means that I'm the kind of person that people don't like. And centering that is harmful in and of itself, but it also keeps us from dealing with the real issue. So I'm excited and interested in tackling that binary to see what is your self-concept tied up in? What do you think about yourself, or what do you need other people to think about you that prevents us from doing the work that's necessary?
It's me, Lisa. This is the most fascinating conversation I've had in a long time, and it's great to just be listening in. So when you travel around the state and you bring the good person talk, what do people tell you? Like, what do you hear from them? What kind of situations are they carrying into the room? I'm just curious. Wow. I'm guessing they're all good people. I have to put that out. But
you know what? We hear so many different things. Some people say, well, I don't feel like a good person. I don't have that. I actually think of myself as a bad person. And I have to work to have a sense of confidence that I'm okay. And so the therapist in me comes in a little bit in those conversations to deal with that. And thinking about ourselves as good versus I'm okay is a very different conversation to me. So people will come to this conversation, or they'll be on their way leaving it with different perspectives. So some people will say, oh, well, what I'm taking away from this is that even if I do something that's racist or sexist or homophobic or transphobic, that I'm still a good person, even though I did this, because it's not my fault. It's the system. And it's like, oh, almost.
Skipped a step.
Almost there. The next part is that we interrupt that good person, that idea of good person. Like, it's still so entrenched that even through the conversation, people's focus is on how can I still feel like a good person even when I know that I've done something that is harmful to another person. And so it's layered. We have to come to that step often and work through it to say, what is it about being a good person? Maybe being a good person is not the thing that we want to focus on. Maybe we want to focus on the harm that is done. And knowing that, yes, it is a system. Yes, it's a system that we are all a part of, that we've all been coached in. And so those messages have been internalized by all of us, right? That is true. And when we know about it, yes, we are responsible for it. We are responsible for our behavior. We are responsible for interrupting these systems. And it's not about saying I'm still a good person, because that is, again, making it about our ideas about who we are, or our ideas about who we want people to believe us to be, rather than focusing on what matters, which is working through anti-racism and anti-sexism and subverting this system of oppression.
So you asked the question in this conversation, what are our moral responsibilities in a society of privilege, power, and oppression? Which is a really great question. And given, and my understanding is that it's helping people to recognize that behavior takes place in a context of structural oppression and privilege. Mm-hmm. So intent aside, we're all part of it.
Absolutely.
Right. So given that, I mean, do you have answers for this? Or in the course of the conversation, how is it that we begin to both recognize, you know, that we're part of this larger structural system, whether or not we like it or not, and we need to do something to move in a different direction?
Yeah, absolutely. So part of the thing that I ask people to do in this conversation project is to do some internal reflection about when they didn't feel like they lived up to their own ideas of being a good person, like when they fell short of their own standard of goodness. And just getting that process started allows people to think and self-reflect about ways that they've participated in this structure, because we all do, because we're the structure cannot exist without us participating in it. And so I ask people to do that. And then toward the end of the conversation, I ask people how they intend to interact with people that they know, people that they love, people that they trust, that they care about, how they tend to interact with those people when they notice the good people in their lives, right? Because we wouldn't be with or near them if we didn't believe somewhat that they were good people. How they intend in those interpersonal interactions to interrupt the behavior. So when you're at your table over your holidays, and you hear a loved one saying something or espousing some oppressive rhetoric, what will you do? What will you say? Will you say, oh, I know that they didn't mean it like that, or they're from a different generation and that's their time? Will you placate them? Will you pacify the situation? Or will you do something that actually interrupts what is happening? And that's the challenge that I ask people to leave with from this conversation, is thinking about their interpersonal interactions.
Yeah, because Sean called up just now and said, how can we be well-adjusted in an unjust society? Maybe that's not even the question that we're asking. That's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Stop thinking of yourself as a good person or the need to be a good person. You know, Sean, listen up. Listen better now. I'm putting this out. We're talking about when we as what do you why? I guess I want to say a privileged white middle class woman in a given situation. Like, how do we walk our talk? I guess if I was going to bumper sticker it, that's kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Not how to spend less money on therapy. I put that on the table. I did. Because another thing about what you're saying is, I come from one of those families where some people voted for Donald Trump, some people voted for Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. I would never vote for either of those people. God bless mm-hmm. everyone in the world right now. And so there's never even one interruption that really changes someone's course. It's like when I talk to my sisters and I talk to my mom and my uncles and aunties, it's more like, this is relational. You can say what you're going to say in front of me, but I'm going to say something about it, and I'm going to remind you that not everybody has those same values you have.
Yeah.
And this is a reason why maybe we could be more inclusive or something like that. So I just put a bunch of stuff on the table, but it reminds me of Angela Davis when I was in college. She said this at a lecture, you know, you should always interrupt everything all the time, mm-hmm. every chance you have. Mm-hmm. And that's a really tall order. And
it's exhausting.
And it's more than one incident. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's not something that just happens once and you're done.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
No, absolutely. And to Sean's point, I think that's what I talk about with my clients, because that's a part of what is wrong with the mental health field now, with trying to assist people or putting you know, it back on the person to say, you know, how can you be well adjusted? What can you do better in your life? And even self-care, right? The concept of self-care, even rubs me a little bit of a wrong way, because it puts the onus back on the person to be someone who can thrive in a society. For many of us, that was not meant for us to even survive, and let alone thrive. So to Sean's point about how can we be adjusted in a maladjusted society, it's difficult, right? And so that's part of the work that I do with supporting marginalized communities and coaching other mental health professionals in their work with marginalized communities, to understand that's real, that it's real to say, well, I'm seeing shootings on my social media feed every other week of people that look like me. How am I supposed to live well? How am I supposed to go to work and do well with that? When I hear about sexual assault happening at a national level daily by people in power, and I'm experiencing it too at my work, how am I supposed to do well with that? And that's real. And so I honor that. And that's a part of the work.
I'm wondering, you know, we've been talking a lot about interrupting conversations or changing conversations. Can conversations lead to structural change?
I think so. And I think that's the hope of the Conversation Project. At the very least, people, they're talking with each other in a way that doesn't happen very often. I was going to say anymore, but I don't even know if it ever really happened where people are talking and actually listening to each other, especially on conversations on topics that are contentious, where
people tend to just avoid them.
Yeah, people avoid them. People don't want to talk. And you're in a room most often with a group of strangers. And so that adds another layer of complexity with it. And so I do think it has a role in making structural change, because people in those rooms, we're a part of the system. People in those rooms are change makers. And as a whole, the structure does not replicate itself. We replicate it daily in our interactions. And so if we think about our own participation and the participation of the people around us, then inevitably at some point we come to a place of creating structural change.
If you are just joining us, this is KBOO Portland, and this is the Radio Activist. I am Suzanne LeGrand, together today with Lisa Loving, talking to Brittany Wake about all kinds of really fascinating subjects. Brittany, do you have other projects in the work besides, and how can people find you if they're interested in being a part of the work that you do?
Absolutely. So I also do full-time. I'm a full-time counselor as well. So
you're busy.
I'm very busy. Yeah. Working with clients and working with, even within my own work system to provide education about the way that both staff and, clients are affected by oppression and the way that those things are replicated in our own system. So very busy, but I'm always open to interacting with folks. I do the conversation pretty regularly. Actually, I have another one coming up. I believe it's closed, though, at Linfield College tomorrow evening for their Black History Month celebration.
Can people call you and organize a conversation that you would if they're interested in this work?
Absolutely. So folks can reach out to Oregon Humanities, but also my website is Catch the Wake, CATCH, the Wake, .org. And so it's a cute little pun on my last name is That's Wake great. And Woke. And yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Brittany, for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, so I'm Lisa. We're wrapping up this segment. I'm reaching out to the Magical Engineering Pixie. It's time for us to switch, and we're making magic and miracles happen right now. This show blows my mind because it becomes synchronicitous at a certain point. I'm Lisa. I'll invite a guest. my compatriot Suzanne will invite a guest, and somehow the guests are connected in ways that are super surprising. So last week was amazing, where we had Partnership for Safety and Justice, and we also had Renee Mitchell in her with her I Am More project, and they're talking about the same thing from completely different lenses. But anyway, this is KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa Loving. If you just tuned in, this is The Radio Activist, and we are shifting to a tough topic of discussion, but one that's constantly on the minds of many, and that's suicide. We're joined on the line by Morgan Leitz. She's with the Oregon Youth Line of Lines for Life Suicide Prevention Services. Morgan, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It's hard to launch this conversation, really. But I want to say, you know, there's people in my networks who are suffering with this issue. And I just wanted to start out by saying, how can we best support the people we love who are feeling suicidal? Is there something we can do?
And I would say the answer is definitely yes. And I think a lot of folks are really, really struggling right now with this issue. And we're seeing, you know, more people who are hurting and more people who are having a hard time. And so many folks who are wanting to know, how do we support people and how can we be there for those that we love who are having a hard time? It almost seems like a really simple answer, but definitely it is not. And that is just talking to each other, having conversations, being willing to talk about the really tough stuff. I think one of the most common concerns or fears that folks have is if we ask about suicide or we talk about it, that it's going to push somebody to make that choice or to take that action. And it has been shown over and over and over again, I mean, by research, but also just person to person, that by having these conversations and talking about it and letting folks know that there is support and there is hope and there is care out there, that it helps them to know that they're not alone and that they can get the support that they need and that they deserve.
All right. Can you talk a little bit about Lines for Life, which is the overall organization that you're with? What does Lines for Life do, and how did the Youth Line get started?
Yeah, so Lines for Life is an agency that works to prevent substance abuse and suicide and promote mental wellness. And so we have a couple ways that we do that in working with policymakers and working kind of in prevention, you know, going into middle and high school classrooms and educating on mental health and wellness. And going, you know, working with folks who are kind of the forerunners of trying to stem some of the opioid crisis. And then, of course, we answer our crisis lines. So we are the Oregon affiliate of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And we also answer the Oregon Alcohol and Drug Helpline and the Military Helpline. And the Youth Line is our fourth kind of main crisis line that we answer. And we started in, I believe, 2000. And we are a teen-to-teen help support and crisis line. So we are there to support teens with whatever they might be going through, from a fight with a family member, a breakup, you know, a failed test, up to including young folks who are, you know, actively struggling with maybe some really intense mental health symptoms or struggling, actively struggling with suicide. Our call workers are other teenagers, so folks who between the ages of 15 and 20 who are go through 55 hours of training to offer support to their peers with whatever they might be experiencing. So all of our lines are volunteer run, so across the board from the Lifeline all the way to the Youth Line, volunteer answered. And so all of our volunteers go through extensive training to be able to support folks with whatever they might be experiencing and help them to not only work through that in the moment and stay safe and get the help that they need, but also work to find the right resources so that they can be healthy and well.
If you just tuned in, we're live on the line with Morgan Leitz. She's the Oregon Youth Line of Lines for Life staff person working on suicide prevention services. And I want to come back and ask you about the teenage volunteers a little bit later. But Morgan, is there a common thread in the stories or experiences of the people who turn to you for help specifically, especially the young people?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think one of the things, like, folks reach out to us for all sorts of different reasons, but one of the main things is either an inability or a fear to reach out and get support, or to feel like there is anybody out there who will support them. So feelings of isolation and loneliness, and like they're the only ones who are in this space, or that no one is understanding or able to hear them. And that's not to say that they don't have supports in their life, but sometimes there's a lot of fear about reaching out to those supports and not wanting to cause any stress or burden for the other folks in their world. And so that is something that we hear a lot, is either not knowing how to talk to somebody or not knowing who to talk to about what's going on for them. And so one of the things that we work with, work on with our callers is not only finding those resources, but how do we have these really, really tough conversations? And sometimes the folks that we have who reach out to us are folks who don't know how to talk to their loved ones who are hurting. So we also talk to them and work with them on ways that they can reach out, ask good questions, you know, let them know that they care, and work through these really tough topics and ensure that folks are getting the support that they need.
So if I understand that, maybe I misunderstood what you just said, but some of the people that contact you are not necessarily the people that are themselves experiencing suicidal ideation. They might be loved ones of those people trying to figure out how they can have a positive impact. Did I hear that right? Can people who are not suicidal contact you?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we... So on our different lines, kind of, we have kind of different focuses on what we support with, but anybody who is struggling, whether it's their own struggles or they're worried about somebody that in their world that might be having struggles, can reach out to us and get support for whatever they're going through. And not only kind of emotional support for themselves, but again, kind of some ideas on what are next steps to take to ensure that everybody is getting what they need and what they deserve. Mm.
I have a question for you. That people feel so isolated or unable to connect.
Here, repeat the whole question.
I'm sorry. Why is it, you're saying that a lot of people are calling because they feel alone. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas about why people feel so alone these days.
That is a phenomenal question. I think sometimes the struggle is that we don't, trying to think of how to word this, I apologize.
This is a really hard topic.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And it's really hard to talk about. And I think that's where the challenge is, right? Is we want to make sure that we put our best face forward and that we're, you know, people around us know that we're happier that things are going well. And it's really hard when things aren't going well. And there's a fear sometimes, I think, in talking about that and in saying, I'm having a really hard time right now. And either that's because I don't know how to say that to somebody, or because I'm not quite sure how they're going to respond, or I'm worried that, you know, they might not necessarily be able to hear that and be able to help me and get the support that I need. And so I think there are times where, you know, if we're the ones who are hurting, it's hard to say that out loud, but it's also hard for the person who is in a position where they don't know how to respond when someone is hurting. And so maybe they don't know what to say. They don't know. They might, some people even dismiss it because they don't want their loved one to be hurting so much. So they're like, it's okay. It's just a bad day. Right. And I think that nobody who says that is trying to be harmful in any way. I think it's just that we don't know how to have these tough conversations, and we're afraid that if we have them, we might make it worse. That was a very long drawn out answer.
No, that was great.
This is really helpful.
Yeah. And in your training with volunteers, what is the way to respond that helps people to feel that they are actually heard?
Yeah, because that's what I was going to say. Is there a best way to listen to a friend who's struggling? Yeah. Or are there things you should never do?
Mm.
It seems like it's for keeps, and we don't want to mess around, you know?
Yeah.
And the first thing we always start with is thank you. Because we know these topics are so hard, because we know it takes so much strength and so much courage to reach out and say, I'm hurting and I'm in a really dark place right now and I need help. And so
actually appreciating and validating people's strength.
Wow.
Yeah, and saying thank you for being open about this with me. Thank you for telling me. And then just giving them the space to talk about what's going on for them. We don't want to make things harder for someone. And so sometimes we will jump to, well, let's talk about all the good things, right? Because the good things are these are all the things that are awesome in your world. And that's definitely something that is a phenomenal thing to talk about. But for someone who's hurting, particularly for somebody who's in a place where they're having thoughts of suicide, oftentimes they don't get to talk about what brought them to this place. And so if they feel like they can't get any of that out, it just kind of sits there and it just gets heavier and can hurt more. And so by giving somebody the space to just talk about what is bringing them to this place, what is causing them this hurt, it can give them a chance to feel less alone about less alone in their situation, but also to be heard and validated that, you know, it's tough what they're going through and that they deserve support and that they deserve care and they don't deserve to be feeling this way anymore.
It's so interesting to me, Morgan. We had an incredible guest in the first half hour of this show. And I wanted to ask her, but I didn't get the chance. What about the people in our society? We demonize mental health assistants. We I come from a military family, but but also law enforcement. It's like they're demonized if they reach out for mental health help. And I know it's that the same way in a lot of communities, especially working class communities, because that's where I came from. And yet if we don't reach out for mental health help, it gets worse. Time does not heal all wounds. But this one gets me. Like, I have a couple people in my life that I just love so much, and they have real mental health problems, and it would never, ever, even ever consider, it wouldn't even occur to them to reach out for therapy or a counselor, because it's like people think, well, I'm crazy if I do that. I mean, and I don't know what you think about that, but I just wish that we could, like you said, honor each other for our mental health needs the way we do for our physical health needs, which in America and the United States is hard enough. But I didn't know if you want to address that. Like, is there, you know, I know I don't, I keep asking people, do you have a good therapist? But that's probably not the right thing to do. But I mean, can you talk about that? Is this a long-term thing that maybe counseling or therapy could help over time for someone, for those of us maybe listening now and don't want to feel like this anymore?
To be honest, I think therapy can help everybody. I think that the most common response we get actually when we talk to particularly our young folks actually about whether or not they've ever talked to a therapist is, well, I'm not crazy. And my response is, I know. Have you ever talked to a therapist, right? Like, I don't love the word crazy. I think there's, you know, people have different mental health. Every single one of us on this earth, has mental health. And some days our mental health is doing amazingly, and some days it's not so much. And some days it gets to a place where we have a mental illness and we need some extra support, and that is okay. And like you just said, and I'm going to reiterate it because I think it's so important, mental health and physical health are the same thing. It is just a different part of our body that is needing a little extra help and support. And we wouldn't question going to the doctor for the flu or for asthma or for a broken leg or to get help with our diabetes. And I think that we shouldn't ever question or struggle in needing to get help for our depression or anxiety or our thoughts of suicide or whatever might be coming up for us, because it is just a different part of our body that's needing help and needing treatment at that time. And so I think that different areas and different cultures are really working towards. I know law enforcement and military have had some struggles in the past. I know they're trying to work through those and trying to move forward in the ways they support their folks. And I know more and more these conversations are being had with different groups of people who maybe didn't talk about mental health before, didn't know how, or weren't quite sure exactly what it was. And so we are moving forward in those conversations. And I think...
Are you there? Is Morgan there? I think we may have just lost Morgan. I apologize for that. Oh, I hear her back. Cool.
My phone.
Yay! Here comes technology, and I'm going to ask about cell phones in a minute. But yeah, you know, it's interesting. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, we are heading in the right direction. Of course, we still have a long way to go, but I think we're moving forward, which is really good, in being able to have these conversations in a different way. And part of that, I think, is due to the fact that younger and younger, we are having conversations about mental health. We are having conversations about mental health with middle schoolers, with high schoolers, as part of their health curriculum. And so as we kind of help our young folks to know that it's okay to talk about, we have folks who are growing up being used to having conversations about mental health and being used to being able to say, you know, my mental health isn't doing so awesome today, and here's the way I can get help.
No, I have a question about that. We talk about, we know that to keep a body healthy, we need to, you know, eat good food and exercise. What is mm-hmm. the equivalent in mental health?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there are lots of different ways folks can do it. I think, you know, self-care is the word we use all the time, and that I think has lots of different meanings to different people. For some folks, that is bubble baths and going out with friends and, you know, eating a piece of chocolate cake, which is awesome. And for some folks, what that means is taking some time when you're having an anxiety attack and doing a breathing exercise or a grounding exercise. It means maybe sometimes saying no to that fourth thing that you had to do that day when you have six other things to do the next day. It's taking those times to set those boundaries and take that time for you and to kind of recognize when our mental health isn't doing as awesome as we would love it to be and knowing what to do next. Mm-hmm. So whether that be calling a friend and talking, whether that being taking some time and, you know, doing maybe some mindfulness exercises can be really helpful for folks. Maybe that means, you know, taking 15 minutes out of your day to read a little bit of your favorite book or to, you know, watch your favorite, you know, an episode of your favorite TV show. And sometimes that means saying, right now I'm not doing really well and I need to go and talk to somebody about it. And so whether that be reach out to a therapist or a crisis line or another support system that can kind of help when our mental health is not doing what we would love it to. We know that we do yearly checkups for our physical health. And I think that in the perfect world, we would have the same thing for our mental health. We would treat it exactly the same. But I think for right now, just knowing when we're having a hard time and knowing what helps us to step out of that hard time. And when we can't, who can we reach out to get the help and support that we deserve? You know, whoever that happens to be.
I wanted to jump in a couple things. Dr. Dan Siegel, right? Everybody knows Dr. Dan mm-hmm. Siegel. Dr. Dan Siegel is this really interesting guy, and he created this thing called the Healthy Mind Platter. It's kind of like his take on the food pyramid. The food pyramid concept has kind of been thrown out. Whatever. You love it, you hate it. I don't. Mm-hmm. But this is really interesting. And he identifies seven areas, and Morgan touched on a lot of them, but there are a couple that we don't think about, and one of them is sleep. So on Dr. Dan Siegel's Healthy Mind Platter, there's sleep time, physical time, which is exercise, focus time, which is kind of like your work or your, you know, your vision of your work, what you want to do, that is your work. Then there's connecting time, which is like Morgan said, sometimes the healthiest people get together with friends and laugh, actually. We know that. Study mm-hmm. has borne that out. Okay. I should spend less time in my cave. Play time is its own thing, which can be physical play or it can be playing with games. It does stuff to your brain. The inside of your brain is it's like a muscle. Downtime is when you literally are sitting under a tree and not doing anything at all. You need that. Mm-hmm. And then time in is the last piece, and that's the time you spend focusing on your mental health and focusing on being a balanced person, which really interests me a lot. So that's the Healthy Mind Platter. When I first was exposed to that, I was like, it hadn't occurred to me that sleep was so important, mm-hmm. and it can be really a big deal.
Oh, it's vital.
Mm-hmm. And Morgan had also talked, we had talked about people in the military. And one of the things that really always freaked me out about our current wars in the United States is that we've had far more soldiers kill themselves than die in the battlefield. Mm-hmm. And so this issue of how do we even make it safe for the people we love who are part of this, I want to say toxic masculinity culture, to giving ourselves mm-hmm. permission to be vulnerable. And like Morgan said, ouch, ouch, my brain hurts. I'm going to the brain doctor. Here's mm-hmm. a band-aid. Like, come on. It's a thing that we can do that's kind of important. And I wanted to slightly shift the conversation just slightly. And again, this whole topic freaks me out. Like I'm worried of saying the wrong thing, but it seems like in the old days, I just knew fewer people that killed themselves. And when that happened, I'd get a phone call, right? People would call, mm-hmm. they'd reach out and say, oh my God, this thing happened. Now I hear about the loss of loved ones from suicide specifically on social media. And there's all these rules mm-hmm. around how people post those things and what you can say, what you could say, what you should never say. And I just wanted to say, Morgan, am I imagining that? Does social media specifically have some impact on this issue? Is there something going on there, or am I imagining it?
So there's a lot of research happening right now about social media and its link to mental health and wellness and suicide. And nothing definitive that I have seen or that I've come out, like, because as soon as I see a study that says one thing, I see another one that says something different.
Eat three grapefruit and you're fine. Yeah, I've, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I will say that I think, much like other things in our world, social media can be an amazing, wonderful way for folks to connect, and it can be really scary. There are issues that can come up as part of social media. So, you know, isolation, so feeling like we're not connecting with the folks around us, this, you know, fact that everybody on social media puts their best face forward, right? And so if I'm having a hard time, it's really hard for me to see that everybody else is going out with friends and taking trips and doing all of these wonderful things. And even though all of us have our bad days, very rarely do we show those bad days on social media. And so it can be really, really hard if someone is already feeling isolated to then see the best of everybody else's worlds and feel like they're not having that as well. And so but where social media can be really, really helpful is if folks are struggling to find a community, or if they are needing kind of some extra or maybe specific support from a group, it can be really helpful for them to reach out and find folks who are like them online and who are like them on social media, which is phenomenal. And my answer to almost everything is moderation is key, right? As long as we are still doing those things that we can to take care of ourselves outside of social media. So yeah, I definitely go on social media a significant amount of my life, but also there are times where I'm like, I think I'm done now. I need to go for a hike, or I need to go and spend some time with friends, or maybe just take a couple minutes for myself drinking my coffee, right? So I have no definitive answer as to whether or not, or I guess what effect social media has, because we're still working on the research on that. And it's the fact that it is such a huge part of our lives is still relatively new. But always, I think moderation is key to make sure that we're engaging with it in a healthy way.
Morgan, I want to ask you kind of a personal question. What brought you to this work? Because this is an incredible lift. You got the world on your shoulders. What made you get involved with this, and how did you prepare yourself to do it?
I have had loved ones in my life who have struggled pretty significantly. I am a suicide loss survivor. And so when I was in college, I was actually going to school for psychology, and there was a sign that was like, come be a crisis worker. And I was like, wow, that's a really cool idea. Because I think one of the things that I have felt from a very young age is that no one deserves to be alone. Loneliness, isolation, those are the things that I think, on top of all of the other things that cause us stress in our world, those are the hardest. And those in conjunction with the other stressors just make things so much more difficult. And so the idea that I could maybe help somebody in that time to not feel so alone was something that really spoke to me. And I am honored to be able to do this work and to be able to talk to the phenomenally strong and brave people who reach out to us every single day and talk to us about the darkest times of their lives.
Wow. And now I want to double back and ask you about those teenage volunteers. Mm-hmm. Where do you get them? Who the heck are they? Can we invite them for dinner?
They are amazing.
How old are they? Where do they come from? Like 55 hours of training. Like, talk about those people, those kids.
Amazing youth. So our young folks range between the ages of 15 and 20, and they come from all over the Portland metro area. And we actually just opened a satellite team in Central Oregon. So we also have some amazing young folks in Central Oregon who are joining our team. But some of us found out about it through friends. Some of us kind of saw something at school. Some of us had their own lived experience and so wanted to kind of give back, and so found us through that. So we have young folks who, all sorts of different ways that they find out about us. We do educational presentations in middle and high school classrooms. And so for some folks, we went out to their school and talked about mental health and wellness, and they wanted to be part of part of the movement to be agents of change and help young folks know that it is okay to talk about mental health and that they deserve support for their mental health. So, we get young folks from all over the spectrum of what brought them to this work. And they do, it's an amazing commitment. They do 55 hours of training, and then we ask for a one-year commitment for from our volunteers. And the vast majority of them stay longer if they can. And just the amazing privilege it is to work with such compassionate, intelligent, insightful, aware youth is just, every single day is amazing. They're just amazing young folks.
If you just tuned in, we're live on the line with Morgan Leitz. She's with Oregon Youth Line. We're talking about suicide prevention services. We're thinking about running out of show now. We're getting close to the top of the hour. So, but we still have a few minutes. So Morgan, okay, I want to ask you just some just basic questions. Are there myths about suicide?
Yes. The strongest myth that exists that we have been fighting for so long is that if you ask about suicide or if you talk about suicide with a loved one, that that will push them to take action to end their life. And I mentioned this at the beginning, but I must say it again because it's so important. Asking the question is the most powerful way that we can let somebody know that we see that they're hurting, and let somebody know that we are willing to have that conversation with them. We are willing to talk to them about what is going on. And so if we notice someone is hurting, if we notice somebody is isolating or is changing their behavior, or there's just something, my gut is telling me there's something going on for this person, check in, ask how they're doing. If you're thinking they're having thoughts of suicide, ask. Are you thinking about killing yourself? Are you thinking about ending your life? And if they say yes, say thank you, and then just be with them. Thank you for telling me that you're having these thoughts, and let them talk about what's going on. And if you don't feel like you're able to do that, that's okay. It can be a really hard conversation for both people. Reach out to a crisis line. Get to somebody that they can talk to, because again, nobody deserves to be alone in this. And that, you know, the more we reach out, the more we can connect, the more likely we can make sure that folks are getting the support that they deserve, and that they can step away from this crisis and be healthy and well.
You know, it's interesting, Morgan, there's considered to be a suicide epidemic around the United States, and it's considered, there statistically, it's been seen that around the world, suicide itself is climbing, and that there are communities that traditionally in the United States were more resilient against that, but those communities are also becoming increasingly impacted. I was surprised as I was researching this to find out that there's actually a couple of occupations that we don't even think about that are very, very linked to suicide. One of them is the medical profession, that in Victorian England is the first time that researchers realized that doctors kill themselves at a higher rate than other people. And that I was reading something recently, veterinarians in the United States also do the same thing. And there's so many people suffering with this issue that we don't even think about. I just want to ask you one more time, Morgan, what are the things that everyone listening right now should know about suicide? Is there anything that we should all know? You just put out a list, but let's draw a line under that list.
Please, if you are having thoughts of suicide, please, please, please know that you deserve help. You deserve support. There are people out there who care about you and want to help you. And if you know somebody who you think is having thoughts of suicide, please check in, ask. If you're not feeling comfortable to ask, reach out to a crisis line or a therapist. We're happy to kind of work through that process and help you to do that. I think no one deserves to be alone. And suicidal crises, there is hope. People can get help, can get support, can step away from that crisis and not have to feel that way anymore. And so I'm just going to go back to, you do not have to be alone. You are not alone in this. And there are people who care about you, and you deserve help, you deserve support, and you matter.
That was Morgan Leitz. She's with the Oregon Youth Line of Lines for Life Suicide Prevention Services. We love you so much, Morgan. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you so, so much for having me.
Absolutely. Find out more about Lines for Life at linesforlife.org. That's F-O-R spelled out, linesforlife.org. Learn more about the incredible work of Brittany Wake on her website, catchthewake.org. That's Wake, W-A-K-E. Wake up. online, catchthewake.org. This is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This has been The Radio Activist. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm here with my beloved friend and compatriot, Suzanne LeGrand. Thanks to our engineer, Tammy Dean.
Thank you.
Love you so much, Tammy. Also, the KBOO volunteer coordinator is Ani Haynes. Radical inclusion is her game. Contact her to be a volunteer at this station. Volunteer at kboo.fm. You could be behind this mic. We are Radio Active. Stay tuned.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9:59. Stay tuned because there, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein today, broadcasting from Tucson, Arizona, is up next. He'll be speaking, probably among other topics, with ethnic studies professor and human rights activist Nolan Cabrera. All that's coming up at 10. And then at 11, we got a live hour of the food show. Stay tuned for that. Thanks for tuning into KBOO this morning. One couple of announcements, and then we'll get right to Flashpoints.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor, Demilitarizing the Pacific, on Wednesday, February 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Peace House in Portland. Demilitarizing the Pacific features three indigenous women speaking on the destruction of a coral reef to expand a military base in Japan, curbing military buildup in Guam, and peace and justice in Hawaii. Again, that's Demilitarizing the Pacific on Wednesday, February 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Peace House, 2116 Northeast 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.